The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for another edition of Civics 101, a podcast refresher course on some basics you may have forgotten or slept through in school. Many of you have asked about the function and powers of the Supreme Court, that is, the judicial branch, one of the three pillars of government. It's going to take a few episodes to really dig into the court and its decisions, but today we're specifically trying to answer whether and how Supreme Court decisions can be overturned. How do they get challenged? Does any person, organization, or branch of government have the authority to change the established law of the land? Our guide to the nation's highest court is Linda Monk. She's a constitutional scholar, a journalist, and author of User's Guides to the Constitution and to the Bill of Rights. She advised the PBS series Constitutional USA with Peter Sagal and consulted on the Newseum in Washington, D.C., among other distinctions. Linda, so glad to have you with us on Civics 101.
Well, thanks for inviting me. And Civics 101, we can always use a refresher course, all of us.
With that in mind, we're starting with some basics. How is the Supreme Court laid out in the Constitution?
Well, it's laid out in Article 3. There are seven articles in the original Constitution. Article 3 is the judiciary, and maybe no surprise, it's the shortest article, meaning the least words are given to them. In fact, Alexander Hamilton, everybody's favorite Broadway musical star now, said that the judiciary was the least dangerous branch because they had neither force nor will, but only judgment. So of all the branches of government, they're the most dependent on we the people giving them the support that they need for the role of an independent judiciary.
Very short explanation of the Supreme Court. How about required number of justices?
That, too, has changed throughout history. They've been as little as five and as many as, well, close to 9 to 11, sometimes 10. It's varied by statute. According, Congress has the power under Article 3 to designate the number of justices. It's not set forth in the Constitution directly. And as you probably remember, FDR during the New Deal had a very famous court packing plan, and the people were in favor of his policies, which the Supreme Court was striking down. But when he actually tried to change the number of courts, the people rallied in favor of the court, which was very surprising at the time. So that's a great example of where even when the president pushes back, even a popular president, if the president pushes too hard, the people like this notion of an independent judiciary that is set up in the Constitution.
We do have these three branches of government, the executive, the legislative, the judicial. Is it fair to say that the Supreme Court gets the final word for all of those three branches?
Well, there's another avenue to that, which is we the people. We may not be a specific branch of government, but we're the first three words in the Constitution, we the people of the United States. We have the ultimate power in the determination of what the Constitution means through constitutional amendment. So even the Supreme Court doesn't have the final word. And we the people have in fact enacted constitutional amendments that overturned Supreme Court decisions, the Dred Scott decision being the most notable, which said that no African American, free or slave, could ever be a citizen of the United States. And in the 14th Amendment, about 10 years later, we the people say all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States and the state in which they live.
A Supreme Court decision can be overturned by a constitutional amendment.
Yes.
How about just a new law, a legislature?
No, a legislature cannot overturn a Supreme Court decision that's based on the Constitution. The Supreme Court also makes decisions that are based on statutes. That's the lower level of law that Congress passes. For instance, the most recent one, or one of the more recent ones, had to do with equal pay. A woman named Lily Ledbetter was trying to get back pay for 20 years in which she was paid less than male cohorts. The Supreme Court ruled that under the law as it existed at the time, she couldn't get all that back pay. Then Congress passed a new law, guess what it was called, the Lily Ledbetter Act, that enabled women going forward to be able to get all that back pay. So that was a Supreme Court decision that was based on an underlying statute that then Congress changed the statute to countermand how the Supreme Court had ruled about the interpretation of that statute. But once we get into the Constitution, where we're talking about search and seizure or rights to gun control or a woman's privacy in her body, any of those constitutional rights, if the Supreme Court cites that in its decision, Congress can't override that because it's based on the Constitution. The only thing that can override it is a constitutional amendment.
Can the Supreme Court overturn congressional legislation?
Oh, absolutely. That's their job one. If it conflicts with the Constitution, when that's what was really established in Marbury versus Madison, was that the court had the power to say what the law is. And what they did in that decision was to strike down the Judiciary Act, which had allowed a lot of these judges to be appointed, and said that if you had a problem with that, you could appeal directly to the Supreme Court, whereas the Supreme Court is supposed to be an appellate court, and only Congress can change the jurisdiction, but it's still within what the Constitution did. And so the Supreme Court struck down that Judiciary Act because it expanded the court's jurisdiction contrary to what the Constitution said.
So can the Supreme Court overturn a previous Supreme Court's decision?
If it's based on the Constitution and not a statutory law.
Okay, so what would an example be of that?
That's happened quite recently. Bowers versus Hardwick had established that state laws that outlawed sodomy, and depending on your view, the listening audience, you can define that on your website, but it was a law that applied to sexual conduct. Michael Hardwick had a criminal conviction because of that, and the Supreme Court upheld that criminal law. Then later, in Lawrence versus Texas, Justice Kennedy on the court led the majority, again 5-4, saying that such laws were unconstitutional. So, and that happened within a period of about 10 to 15 years.
Okay, so how about with the case of Dred Scott? Since the Dred Scott case was overturned by constitutional amendment,
and the Civil War. We need to put that little part in
yes,
there, too.
There was that. There was that scuffle. But so that ruling has never been officially overturned by the Supreme Court itself.
No, it didn't have to be because a constitutional amendment came along. That's the highest, you know, form of authority is the Constitution. The Supreme Court's supposed to interpret the Constitution. So when we the people pass a constitutional amendment that countermands a Supreme Court decision, they have to obey that amendment. They have to obey the Constitution.
Okay, so I really do admire your faith in we the people. But let's just dig into this idea that increasingly we the people's legislators are not necessarily acting on laws, and many things are getting kicked up to the Supreme Court and therefore politicizing this judicial body that is supposed to be independent. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Let me make a clarify about we the people. I'm not saying we the people are always right. I'm saying that we the people always have the ultimate authority. Now, in terms of the politicization of the court, some people would say it's always been political, and you can look back through its history there. Usually people who disagree with what the court's saying are saying the court's political. People who agree with it saying they're following the Constitution. So you have to be careful about those terms, too. But I would say, and this is the heart of your question, Congress doesn't want to take responsibility. That has always been true from the beginning of the Republic. Congress in Article 1 has the most words given to it. The framers thought that Congress was going to be the dominant branch of the U.S. government, fully intended it. By the framers' vision, the president has way too much power today. The people, their closest connection to government is through their elected leaders, whether it's the House, the Senate now, or the president. And that's the most direct avenue that the people have is through their elected leaders and participating in nominations for Supreme Court justices.
If this is based on we the people's voice and constitutional law and not politics, then why do the appointees, why do those nominated to the Supreme Court matter so much and divide so politically?
Well, that's a good point. And there are plenty of constitutional scholars who believe that law is politics, that it's just politics in a different realm. And if you, like me, I don't think politics is a dirty word. Politics is our values. The problem is that we disagree about those values. And what the Constitution ultimately tries to do is say, okay, here are some core values, most of them in our Bill of Rights, that we don't think should be subject to a majority vote. And there are also structural guarantees in the Constitution that are not subject to a majority vote. For instance, like the Emoluments Clause that people are upset about with President Trump. That's in the Constitution. It's not supposed to be up to what the majority thinks. So in terms of politicization of the court, I think the people who are the most ideological, who really care the most about their values, understand that a Supreme Court appointment is really critical because they have life tenure. Now, in 1787, that might be 10 or 15 years. Today, it could be 30, 35 years. That's a long time to have that kind of power. And in fact, one of the leading constitutional amendments that is proposed is to limit the term of the Supreme Court to 15 years, period. And then perhaps there wouldn't be quite so much ideological debate about who gets the court seat.
Linda Monk, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Linda Monk, she's a constitutional scholar, journalist, and author of The Words We Live By, Your Annotated Guide to the Constitution, and The Bill of Rights, A User's Guide. She was also series advisor on Constitution USA with Peter Sagal. There's more on her at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Union leaders for the Writers Guild of America struck a tentative deal with studios in the wee hours of May 1st, averting a strike the likes of which we have not seen since a decade ago. The fight is far from over, as writers lament decreased pay and royalties, while streaming networks and on-demand entertainment capture more and more viewers. One filmmaker has a solution. Benjamin. That is the name claimed by the artificial intelligence, or AI, being responsible for a nearly incomprehensible film called Sunspring. Now comes a follow-up, a short called It's No Game, which imagines a world where algorithms do the writing and it is written by an algorithm.
So, as you know, Fair Game Films will no longer be accepting the terms of your little clubs.
All movies need writers.
Agreed. Kind of. No doubt you've both seen this before.
In a future with mass unemployment, young people...
Sunspring was written by an artificial intelligence named Benjamin, resulting in almost a million hits.
Is that a lot?
I don't think so.
So we decided to evolve Benjamin, and now we don't need you anymore.
Annalie Newitz is tech culture editor at Ars Technica, the site where both Sunspring and It's No Game debuted. Annalie, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the plot of It's No Game?
It's No Game is about the impending writer's strike, which luckily did not happen. And it was created for a 24-hour film festival at the London Sci-Fi Film Festival. And so it was written and performed very quickly. And most of it was written by Benjamin, the AI. And the story follows two writers who are worried about the strike, and they're meeting with a producer. And the producer surprises them by saying, guess what? We don't need you. We actually have an AI that can do all the writing. And not only that, but the AI controls these mysterious nanobots that can take over their bodies and force them to act out some of the dialogue that this AI has written, which results in a crazy series of conversations that they have where the AI takes over and reads lines written by an AI that are kind of mashups of things like Shakespeare, Aaron Sorkin movies, and finally, The Crowning Glory, which is television shows from the 80s starring David Hasselhoff. And they actually have David Hasselhoff in there performing these AI-written lines.
There's the headline. So you said most of it written by Benjamin. There are some humans behind Benjamin and both films. Who are they?
That's right. So Oscar Sharp wrote and directed both Sunspring and It's No Game, the follow-up. And Ross Goodwin, his partner, programmed Benjamin the AI. And the way that they program this AI is they basically feed him with what's called a corpus, which is just a big body of written language. And depending on what Benjamin learns from, he spits out different kinds of dialogue. So in this case, he was fed on several different corpuses, one of which was Shakespeare, and then one of which was the Hoffbot corpus, which was mostly, it's a little bit of Baywatch, and then a lot of Knight Rider, which was the show that Hasselhoff was in, where he and an AI car are having adventures. And so what Benjamin does is he guesses at what kinds of things people might say based on the writing that he's learned from. And so because of that, he ends up being really good at finding cliched dialogue, because if you say things a lot, you're more likely to say them again. Huh. So we get a lot of weird cliches in his dialogue.
So is everything created by Benjamin, the dialogue and even the stage direction?
So in Sunspring, which is the first film, Benjamin wrote the entire thing, including stage directions, which is part of why Sunspring is so completely weird, because they have directions like you have to stand in the sky and the ceiling and things like that. And they try to create that, and it comes out like this completely silly science fiction film. But for It's No Game, the follow-up, learning from their experience with the first film, Oscar and Ross decided to have Benjamin only write dialogue. And so the way they did that was, instead of feeding him on scripts, they fed him on subtitles from all of the TV and movies that he was learning from. So he only learned from the dialogue. So he did not. So all the stage directions were written by Oscar, and all of the non-AI dialogue was written by Oscar, the human. Oscar the human.
I'm glad you mentioned subtitles, because I'm thinking of Sunspring. It's borderline nonsensical, the dialogue there. Let's listen to just a bit. Here's actress Elizabeth Gray playing the part of H2.
He was weak. I thought I'd change my mind. It was crazy to take it out. It was a long time ago. He was a little late. I was going to be a moment. I just wanted to tell you that I was much better than he did.
Okay. Could be an art piece, right?
It could be. And what's amazing is that you can almost kind of feel like you know what she's getting at because of the way she's acted the scene. And I love that line where she says, I was going to be a moment. You almost know what she's getting at there. And it's, you know, Benjamin's writing is just a little bit off from the way people would actually talk. It's just these little changes that make it completely silly.
Well, It's No Game, this sort of mashup of, as you said, you know, Aaron Sorkin, Shakespeare, David Hasselhoff scripts from the 80s. It feels a little more natural, but still kind of weird. So would you call it progress? Would you call it a success?
I think it is progress. I think that basically Oscar Sharp has been learning how to work with the AI. And so in this version, they actually created, he and Ross Goodwin created, I think about 6 or 7 different versions of Benjamin. So one of them is the Shakespeare version of Benjamin, one of them is the Aaron Sorkin version of Benjamin, and then one is the Hoffbot version. And so I think because they trained Benjamin on these much more specific types of stories, he wound up coming up with sentences that sounded a little bit more plausible, because it wasn't just a mashup of like a million movies. So when he does, when David Hasselhoff does some of his speeches, a lot of his sentences are real sentences. They don't quite make sense, but they're almost recognizable as something you could imagine him having said in Knight Rider. And that's what's so interesting about it, is that it's almost there, but again, he's sort of, Benjamin loves to recreate these cliches because he's working with probability. Like, what are you most likely to say next? Well, if you've said a certain phrase like, hey guys, let's get out of here, which they say all the time on Knight Rider, you know, he's going to have you say that. And so it ends up sounding like almost like a distillation of every cheesy line that you've heard a million times for like your drinking game or whatever, where you say, you know, drink every time he says this. So it's interesting. I think he is improving, but I think he's also maybe turning into a little bit of a cliche machine, too.
Well, that would be entirely out of bounds in movie making, would it?
No, actually, that's true.
Well, here's a little bit. David Hasselhoff, he has a strange but oddly moving monologue at the end of the film, It's No Game.
I want to be a man.
I got to get out of here. I'm going to make a huge mistake. I need to be with you and explain it to you. I would like to talk to you and explain this and tell you a little story. I want to talk to you. I want to go to the movies. I want to go to the movies.
Any idea what that experience was like for him as an actor?
So I did get a chance to talk to David Hasselhoff when this film debuted, and he said that he and the director, Oscar, had a long conversation before this monologue about how Hasselhoff feels about his life as an actor and how people have kind of turned him into this icon called the Hoff, and that isn't really who he is. He feels like he's just a regular actor. He, you know, does a lot of things. He doesn't just do Baywatch and Knight Rider, and so he really put a lot of feeling into that final scene. I was quite surprised. If you watch it, you know, he's shaking and crying, and he really felt like he was kind of expressing what it was like to be shaped into something that he didn't want to be, which is perfect for this short film because, of course, he's been taken over by AI nanobots that are controlling him and forcing him to be the Hoffbot. So he really, I think he really connected with this character and the idea of being controlled by forces that are beyond you.
The emotion does come across. The meaning may be a little harder to parse. So I wonder if the writers could use this as an example of, okay, this is what happens when you start creating films by AI. Or, alternately, is this the next wave of entertainment?
I think what they're learning is that this gives them a window on what kinds of tropes and ideas come up again and again in certain kinds of movies or certain kinds of television. And so I think it becomes, for writers, it's kind of fun to play around with that stuff and to say, well, what are the most common phrases I might find in a Baywatch episode? And then tweak them. So I think the more that writers work with AI, the more they're going to become kind of tools, maybe not authors quite yet, but tools that writers can play around with if they want to bring in kind of nonsense or if they want to bring in nonsense that almost makes sense. In that way, I think, you know, AI could be just like any other experimental writing, like automatic writing, or when people do collages with words where they cut up a page from a book and then reorder the words. And this just becomes another way of doing those kinds of literary experiments.
Anna Lee Newitz, tech culture editor at Ars Technica and a real writer. Her debut novel, Autonomous, comes out in September. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot.
You'll find links to watch both of the films from the AI that named itself Benjamin at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From Stravinsky Suites to Here Comes Honey Boo Boo, just about every field of art and entertainment has inspired scholarly works and criticism. Comics, not so much. But then there are plenty of people who would consider comics scholarship to be an oxymoron. Comics fans are known to be a passionate and devoted lot who talk a lot to each other, but who may have given up on the idea of explaining what is comics to outsiders. Scott McCloud has. He is author of Understanding Comics, The Invisible Art. Published in 1993, it is one of the seminal volumes for comic book writers and a fascinating guide for anyone interested in the creative process. And Scott McCloud, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So a lot of American kids like you grew up loving comics and the guys in tights. When did you decide it was going to be your profession?
Well, I got into it at the age of 14 because I actually thought I was too old for comics before that. But a friend of mine convinced me to give them a try. And only a year later, at the age of 15, I decided I want to make the things for a living.
Well, it is an art form, you point out early in the book, that suffers from low self-esteem. Is that was that your goal with Understanding Comics, to get some respect?
Yeah, that was part of it. I mean, certainly I felt that comics were worthy of respect, not so much for what we had done, but what we could do. Because I think all art forms really are just a blank page. You know, they're potential. And just as great movies occupy a pretty small minority of all the movies made, or great novels, a small minority of all the novels made, it was more important to me to convey the idea that comics were capable of greatness. And I do think they are, and I'm happy to report that in the last 15, 20 years, we've been finally living up to that potential. Mm.
They've been used as an art form for a really long time. You point out to us that they're pre-Columbian murals that were discovered by Cortez in the 16th century. There's the Bayeux Tapestry from the Norman invasion, and Hogarth's The Rake's Progress and The Harlot's Progress. These are historical documents for us. So what do they share as comics?
Well, all of them have this very simple idea that you're telling a story through pictures in sequence. The pictures occupy the different parts of a canvas at the same time. And what the reader does is really quite remarkable. We accept it as a kind of map of time. So as we move from one space to the next, we're moving from one time to the next. And all of these things that you mentioned and other things too, like certain Egyptian wall paintings, they all use that same basic storytelling technique. And it's something that we use today in what we call comics.
You, in the book Understanding Comics, I think wonderfully, for me, who is not somebody who passionately loves comics, but, you know, argued with my brothers and sisters over who got the funnies first on Sundays and, you know, read old classics, illustrated comics and Archies and that kind of thing. But you employ these visual tools that comics allow. And you write about the abstraction of comics. You know, rather than perfectly shaded, just the power of line enables readers to be sucked in. It gives us some kind of entry point. Why does that work? Can you explain that concept?
Well, there are different ways in which cartooning in particular, that way of simplifying the world, can really pull a reader in. One of them is that it's more universal. If you just draw a circle with two dots and a line to represent a face, you're representing every face there's ever been. Except for the occasional pirate with an eye patch, I suppose. And that has a power to it because the reader is then participating in the creation of a character, not just receiving this very detailed information about another. And in some ways, we see our own faces in that. So when you're reading Peanuts or you're watching The Simpsons, in a way, you're inhabiting those characters and seeing them as a part of yourself. And that can be very, very strong, very powerful, as it makes us feel like we're in almost a virtual emotional space.
It's that participation is with the reader that comes through so strongly in Understanding Comics. You point out to us the way that we read images and read into images as they move through the page. We are the silent accomplice. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, we're there alongside the artist creating the comic as we read it. The comic's only half done. They're just lines on paper until we arrive at it. So one of the examples I give is what happens between the panels. You know, there's no motion between those panels until we imagine the motion. So at one point I say in Understanding Comics that to kill a man between panels is to condemn him to 1,000 deaths, because every reader is going to imagine a different scenario.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you have a one panel with the man being threatened, and in the next panel, you just see the scream, you know, sort of over a cityscape. We fill in that gap.
Yeah, and that's a tremendous jump. You have to take a moment to admire the mind's ability to make that jump, to make that connection. And if you look around you, you realize that we make that connection every day. When we see something on a supermarket shelf and we're only seeing just an eighth of what we're looking for, some soda bottle or a box of cereal, we're filling in the rest. We're imagining the whole.
Do you like comics? Do you love them passionately? Do you not understand them? Well, Understanding Comics is the title of a book that's considered a remarkable new Baedeker of the tunes, says Doonesbury writer and artist Gary Trudeau. It's kind of a guide to how to make comics and how to look at them and interpret them as an art form. Well, you spend a lot of time in this book explaining how comics do work on the mind, or how the brain participates, like how pictures can evoke sensation and emotional response, you know, the wavy lines rising up off the image of a tipped over garbage can, or heat off a coffee cup, or dizziness or pain. Why do these representations work on us?
Well, you know, it's funny, because what happens is we begin by representing the world somewhat literally. And we see this in the evolution of pictorial languages, too, like Chinese. We just start literally drawing what we see. But gradually, over time, through abstraction, through repetition, they become more like language. There's something between a picture and a word that we see in these abstractions. So, for instance, there are these little sweat beads. Sometimes cartoon characters will have a little sweat bead on their forehead. And we know from experience this means they're nervous, they're upset, they're sweating, right? But gradually, cartoonists would draw that sweat bead further and further from the forehead until it became like just a marker, just a little tiny pictogram that simply indicated nervousness. And now a cartoonist could draw a robot and have that same sweat bead over his forehead,
mm-hmm.
even though he has no skin, there's no such thing as a sweat bead on a robot. But we understand it because now it's drifted into the realm of language.
Mm-hmm. How do you, as a comic artist, know how much to show and how much to just leave to the reader?
Well, it's funny. As a theorist, I'm always trying to, you know, work out these things to my satisfaction and explain them as best I can. But as an artist, when I sit down to actually write and draw a comic, I try to forget all of that, and try to channel my own intuition and draw more from the heart.
Comics establish story. You know, there's momentum, there's movement from one action to the next. But yet in this book, you make many references to works of art that are established as great. You know, the static works of art, you know, Marcel Duchamp or Picasso or Munch. Do you want to establish how they operate in the same realm, comics and great works of art, or different realms? I mean, what are you trying to do here?
Well, you know, 20 years ago, I think it was more important to cartoonists, this notion of some kind of equivalency, the notion that comics could go toe-to-toe with other art forms that were more established, that had a richer history, at least in the eyes of the cultural elite. I don't think that's as important as it used to be. But I do think that those connections to the broader world of fine art are still important because, frankly, everything is connected. And I think it's wise for us to always be on the lookout for those connections, that yes, this week's Amazing Spider-Man or a graphic novel down at Barnes & Noble may have something meaningful in common with Guernica. It may have something meaningful in common with, an episode of Orange is the New Black or cake decorating. You know, everything is connected. And what happens is, if you look at anything closely enough, eventually you find yourself drilling down to the core from which all human expression and communication comes from. You know, all of these are different aspects of the same human instinct to communicate.
You argue, or maybe I should say demonstrate, through your drawings, that the comics are one form of mass media where you can still hear individual voices. I wonder what you mean by that.
Well, you know, it took me 5 years to do this latest graphic novel of mine that'll be coming out in a few weeks. It's called The Sculptor. And I thought, wow, 5 years is a long time. You know, a movie only takes, say, 2.5 years to put together. But then when I go to a movie, I'm looking at 1,000 names in the credits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not even an exaggeration. I think there are about 1,000 for most movies.
It always takes two songs now.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I thought, wow, I got to do this all by myself. I can't control exactly how people interpret it, but I think that this is an art form in which you have more control than almost any other. You're able to be very specific when you want to be, more so than, say, prose. But you can also pull back and allow the reader to participate more through simplicity, through iconography. The short answer is it's really good for control freaks, basically. And I'm one of those, I'll confess.
Well, Scott McLeod, I feel like I got schooled today. Thank you.
Thanks, Virginia.
Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Broke for Free, Poddington Bear, and Jazar. We are always in touch at Word of Mouth Radio on Facebook and at Word of Mouth on Twitter. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.